From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a food writer whose mother couldn't tell when food was rancid and sometimes served it to the family. We talk with Ruth Reichel, editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine and former restaurant critic for the New York Times. She's just published her second food memoir. The documentary about baseball Hall of Famer Hank Greenberg is showing on Cinemax this month. We'll hear from Greenberg's son, Steven. Also, David Bianculli reviews last night's concluding episode of Survivor, and Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie Chopper, based on the life of an Australian killer whose crimes turned him into a celebrity. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Writers Guild of America has announced a tentative agreement with Hollywood movie and TV studios. The Writers Guild, which represents 11,000 Hollywood writers, said the agreement would avert a costly and disruptive strike. The two sides have been negotiating for 3 days after the writers' contract expired. They were reportedly as much as $100 million apart when negotiations began. The writers wanted bigger residual payments when their programs go into secondary markets, such as videos, reruns, and overseas distribution. The next big labor challenge for Hollywood will be labor talks with the industry's 135,000 actors, whose contract is set to expire on July 1st. The Pentagon says the Navy spy plane that was forced down on a Chinese island could be fixed and flown back to the United States. NPR's Chad Pergram reports.
Pentagon officials who asked not to be named said technicians from Lockheed Martin have inspected the plane on Hainan Island and determined it could be repaired for flight. The four-engine EP-3 turboprop sustained damage to the nose and engines. 2 weeks ago, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said there was also trouble with flaps on the wings that help control the plane. The EP-3 was loaded with sensitive eavesdropping equipment. The U.S. suspects that while important data was destroyed by the U.S. crew, the Chinese still gained important insights by inspecting the plane. An alternative to flying back the $80 million plane would be to take it apart for shipment on a barge or on another aircraft. China has still not released the EP-3 to the U.S. The team of Lockheed Martin technicians will meet with U.S. Pacific Command in Hawaii Saturday. Chad Pergram, NPR News, Washington.
On Capitol Hill, a last-minute budget change has angered backers of a proposal to help low-income people get health insurance. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
The dispute over the health insurance program was one of the issues that delayed a final congressional vote on the budget resolution until next week. The Senate-passed budget would have allowed $28 billion over 3 years to expand existing public programs like Medicaid and to provide tax credits for employers who help workers pay their insurance premiums. Budget negotiators wanted to stretch the money out over 10 years instead. On Thursday, Oregon Senators Ron Wyden, a Democrat, and Gordon Smith, a Republican, said they'd reached a deal to make the money available over the original 3 years. But the version of the budget officially filed Friday restored the 10-year window. It's one of several issues where disgruntled lawmakers say the language doesn't reflect the agreements they thought they'd reached. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 154 points, or 1.5%, to close at 10,951 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 45 points, or 2%, to close at 2,191. This is NPR News. A federal grand jury has indicted Congressman James Traficant on corruption charges. The Ohio Democrat faces 10 counts, including bribery, tax evasion, and obstruction of justice. He said he'll fight the charges and win, as he did in 1983, when he successfully defended himself against charges that he had ties to organized crime. A new government survey says roughly one American in 10 wound up in the emergency room last year. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
Two government agencies collected data from 66 hospitals last summer and calculated that 31 million people were treated in emergency departments last year because of injuries. Falls were the most common reason, accounting for one of every four visits. The next most common reason? Crush injuries, followed by incidents involving a car, motorcycle, or bicycle. Nearly 2 million trips to the emergency department were the result of violence. Overall, more males than females suffered injuries. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, one of the two agencies involved in the survey, has set up a Center for Injury Prevention and Control. The survey is an attempt to get a better handle on what causes injury so that policymakers can figure out ways to reduce the numbers. Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Washington.
Police in Texas say a serial kidnapping suspect killed himself today after police pulled his car over. An 11-year-old girl who was kidnapped in Houston on Tuesday ran from the car toward police, and the suspect shot himself in the head. The suspect was identified as 48-year-old Gary Cox, a convicted sex offender. Police say they believe Cox abducted two other girls in the past several weeks, held them for days, and later released them. The FBI says Cox may also be responsible for other kidnappings. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from NPR stations and the Amundsen Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Ruth Reichel was restaurant critic for the New York Times, she wanted to dine out incognito, so she used an alias and often wore a wig and phony glasses. But she's opening her life to readers in her memoirs. Reichel, who is now editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, has written the second volume of her memoirs. It's called Comfort Me with Apples, and it's about her adventures with food, friendship, and love. It's a follow-up to her first memoir, the bestseller Tender at the Bone, Growing Up at the Table. I spoke with her in 1998, after Tender at the Bone was published, shortly before she left the Times. You might think Ruth Reichel's love of food dates back to her mother's wonderful home cooking. But you'd be wrong. Her mother was not only a terrible cook, she was what Reichel describes as taste blind. Her mother couldn't tell if food was spoiled, would sometimes serve it that way after it had turned, and have no idea why her family found it nauseating. I asked Reichel how she became a food professional, coming from this taste blind background.
Well, you know, I mean, I really felt that I was sort of shaped by my mother's handicap. You know, I mean, it's the way the children of deaf people are probably more aware of sound. I became very aware of taste because I was so fascinated by the fact that my mother couldn't taste these things. And then in self-defense, I started cooking. And my mother really would make these dreadful concoctions. I mean, she really prided herself on something called everything stew, where she would take everything in the refrigerator, all the leftovers, and put them all together. And one day I was watching her put in leftover turkey and broccoli and a little, you know, can of mushroom soup. And she's throwing things in, and half an apple pie goes in. And she says, you know, I sort of look at her and think, Mom. And she said, oh, it'll be fine. And then she starts throwing everything in. And you know, in defense, I started cooking because I didn't want to eat that.
Now, I know your first experiences in the food world as a professional was working in restaurants. One of the restaurants you worked in was L'Escargot. Would you describe the restaurant?
Well, this was in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I was going to school at the University of Michigan, and it was a very, very fancy French restaurant for the mid-60s, and certainly for Ann Arbor, Michigan, and certainly for a college town. And it was somebody's dream. I mean, I had the great privilege, really, of participating in this mad, passionate dream of the owner who did everything beautifully, which you can't do in a restaurant. I mean, he bought Baccarat crystal, which is insane. I mean, it all breaks in the first month, and Limoges china and wonderful chandeliers. And he brought a chef from the Four Seasons in New York, and he got the best grill man as a sous chef, and wonderful, wonderful waiters and waitresses, real professionals. I mean, the kind of people that you don't see very much anymore, who were very proud of their profession and very good at it. And I've always thought that a really good restaurant, when it runs well, is like being on a movie set. You become a family. It becomes a whole life of its own. And this restaurant was like that. We became very tight. And as we watched this restaurant go down.
Go down?
Well, I mean, it was a dream. Ann Arbor was not a place that could support that kind of a restaurant in those days. And it was very high-end French food at very high-end prices. And people would come once for the curiosity but never come again. And as business really faded, we all pulled together. We really rooted for, what happened was the first chef was a real thief. And I learned a lot about how, most restaurants go under because of employee theft, or many of them do. And this guy was a real pro. He would take whole sides of meat, wrap them in aluminum foil, bury them in the garbage, and then go out after the garbage had been taken out. He would come back in the middle of the night and take these pieces of meat and sell them. Wow. And we all really started rooting for the owner. Nobody wanted to see this going on. And it was no good. Ultimately, it closed.
There was a waiter at this restaurant who kind of initiated you in, yes, in the ways of restaurants, and he told you that the restaurant was a war zone. What did he mean by that?
It's a common thing that waiters say. What he said was that the kitchen was at war with the customers, and we were the go-betweens, and that our job was to make sure that the customers never knew that the kitchen was at war with them. And this entailed a lot of subterfuge. For instance, if a customer wanted to send a steak back because it was cooked too much, he said, now you can go back and you can tell the chef that the customer says it's overcooked. And he's going to scream and yell because he's at war with the customer. On the other hand, if you go back and you're very humble and you say, I made a terrible mistake. He said that he wanted it rare, but I wrote down well done. He'll scream at you, but he'll give you a new steak because he's not at war with you.
Yeah, but he might be at war with you if that happens too much.
Well, it doesn't happen that often, but it was just a matter of us sort of always taking the blame so that we would get big tips. He also really felt that it was our responsibility to come up with a good story for the customers. He said, they should go home with more than a good meal. You have to provide an experience for them that is, that they can talk about. So he encouraged me to pretend that I was a foreign student who was here and had not had enough money, and that I needed to work to support myself. And I developed a great story. My customers would be crying and giving me big tips at the end of it. But he said that this was a good thing because I was really giving them value for their money.
Now, at the New York Times, you're kind of famous for using disguises when you're reviewing a restaurant so that you can't be spotted. So you can eat anonymously. What do you use, wigs?
Not only wigs. I keep buying new wigs. I've now got 11. And I do use those. I also have a lot of glasses. I have fake fingernails. I have whole outfits in different sizes. I'll sometimes put on like three pairs of pants, one over the other, or three skirts, so I look much larger than I am. I'm not normally a makeup person, but I've learned about makeup, and you can really do amazing things with. You can change the shape of your lips and change the color of your eyebrows, and I do all that stuff.
Do you pay cash or use fake credit cards?
I use fake credit cards.
Does the Times help you get them?
No, I have figured out my own strategies for getting them. They don't want to know about how I do this. I also often ask the people I'm with to pay, and then I just write them a check.
Right.
But if you start pulling out wads of cash, it's a little. It's a giveaway. Go out to a really expensive restaurant and pull out $500 in cash. Who carries that kind of money around?
Something you did that was pretty controversial, I think, I don't remember when this was exactly, but you took a star away from the restaurant Le Cirque, which I guess had been, 4 stars, and you demoted it to 3. Do I have that right?
Yes, you have it right.
It was right after you came?
Yeah.
I don't even know how the star rating works and who determines what makes a restaurant 4 or 3 stars or whatever. So why don't we start with an explanation of that?
Well, the star system is very much up to whoever the critic is at the time. And 4 stars is the most that you can get. And it's a very exalted, there are only 6 4-star restaurants at the moment. And it's a very big deal for restaurants.
So when you say 4-star restaurant, this is like a New York Times 4-star restaurant.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And it has a lot of weight to the restaurants. When they get a 4-star rating, it's a very big deal for them. And it brings them lots and lots and lots of business. To demote a restaurant from 3 stars to 2 stars is not such a big deal, but to demote it from 4 stars to 3 stars is huge. This was right after I had arrived in New York 5 years ago. I had not had a star rating system at the LA Times where I'd been for 10 years. I wasn't that impressed with the star system at the time. I mean, I've since come to see how, if nothing else, how economically powerful it is for the restaurants. But I started going to Le Cirque, and they didn't know me, and I was not treated well. And everybody had always, jumped up and down about what a great restaurant it was. And, I had some really terrible experiences there. I went once with another woman, and we were made to wait 45 minutes at the bar for, a supposedly non-smoking table, and we were still stuck in the smoking section. And when I asked for a wine list, a maitre d' came over and snatched it out of my hands after a minute and said, "I need that list," and he took it off to some man nearby, and I couldn't get it back. And then I thought, well, I wonder, after I'd been there a few times, I thought, well, I wonder what will happen if, not if I make a reservation in my own name, but just if I go in undisguised. By then I knew he knew who I was. And sure enough, I go, and I have made the only reservation I could get was like 9:45. But I said, I think I'll go at 9 o'clock and just see what happens. And we get to the door, and there's a huge crowd waiting for tables. And the owner comes, he parts this crowd. It's like the Red Sea parting. And he comes through to me, and he pulls me forward and says, "The King of Spain is waiting in the bar, but your table is ready," and leads me to a table. And I thought, this is too wonderful. I've just got to write about, what happened to me as just me, an ordinary person, and then what happened to me as the restaurant critic of the New York Times, and write about the two experiences.
Now, I could see a restaurant easily explaining this by saying, well, of course we treat our regulars with special care. That's why people become regulars, because they know they're treated as like part of the family. We know what they like to eat. We know what their preferences are. We know whether they smoke or not. And it's lovely, like at a neighborhood restaurant, when you come in all the time, they say hello, they bring you the salad when you sit down, they know what you want. Everybody likes to be treated like a regular.
Absolutely, and regulars deserve to be treated. I mean, they've paid their dues, and they deserve to be treated better. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that ordinary people shouldn't be treated well.
Right.
And there's a real difference between, for instance, not every restaurant can have your table ready when you arrive. I mean, they can't always calculate how long people are going to stay at a table. An apology goes a long way. If they come up to you and say, "I'm so sorry that, can I give you a glass of wine? Can I somehow make this up to you?" You don't feel badly. You don't feel as if you've been dissed. On the other hand, if it's just, go wait over there, we'll let you know when your table is ready. It's a matter of attitude. And Le Cirque at that time was really known for not being particularly nice to ordinary people. I have to say that their attitude has changed dramatically.
Oh, have you changed their star rating?
I have. I mean, they reopened. They closed for a while, and they've reopened in a new location. And I went in many times, in many disguises, and they were wonderful. They were just wonderful. And I really felt that they had sort of seen that there was no point in not trying to be good to everyone.
My guest Ruth Reichel is editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine and former restaurant critic for the New York Times. She's just published her second food memoir. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Yeah.
Let's get back to our interview with Ruth Reichel. Her new food memoir is called Comfort Me with Apples. When we spoke in 1998, she was restaurant critic for the New York Times.
Now, what's your approach to reviewing? How many times do you typically go to a restaurant? How do you order off the menu?
I go endlessly. I mean, I go until I really feel that I've eaten just about everything on the menu, that I've been there with a big group and a small group, on a weekend, on a weeknight, lunch and dinner. I've had every kind of, you know, combination that you can have. I mean, I'm very lucky. I work for an institution that is willing to put this kind of money into it. I would never go fewer than three times. I've gone as many as nine. And I really do try and, you know, get the entire range of experiences that you can have from a restaurant.
What kind of impact have you seen your reviews have, for better and worse, on restaurants?
Well, I felt very good about the Le Cirque thing. I mean, I really felt that that had had an impact, that taking that star away, which really stung. I mean, it's a wonderful restaurant. I mean, the food is terrific. But I think he really thought, you know, times are changing. I think I've seen that women are treated better. I don't think that's just up to me. But I think, you know, it's also changing times. Women are spending more money. They're more businesswomen. The whole sort of cliche about women not tipping so well is not true anymore. But I've certainly seen that change in the last few years. You know, I don't tend to go back to restaurants much after I've been there. So it's not that I, you know, can see the impact. Mm-hmm. But I've certainly read, you know, restaurants saying, you know, they got four stars and, you know, they got 20,000 phone calls the next day.
I want to ask you a little bit about restaurant etiquette. What advice do you have about how much to tip? And when do you think it's appropriate, if ever, to penalize a waiter if the service isn't good or if the food is bad?
Well, if the food is bad, you can't penalize the waiter. That's absolutely not fair. It's not his fault.
Yes.
Now, remember, when you're, you know, listening to this answer, that I am a former waitress for a very long time. I'm a very good tipper. You know, I think that you can make someone's day much, much brighter by tipping well, and another couple dollars isn't going to make that much difference to you. And it's certainly okay to penalize a waiter for things that you know are his fault. I would penalize a waiter for, you know, not being helpful, for things that he said, for demeanor. I would not penalize him for food appearing or not appearing on time.
When do you think it's okay to send back a dish?
It's always okay to send back a dish. You're there to be pleased. I mean, this is your night out. You're paying to get what you want. And, I mean, as a restaurant critic, I never send food back because I don't want to draw attention to myself. But as a civilian, I feel like I am in the restaurant to be pleased, and if it's not what I wanted, I send it back.
From your years as a waitress, what are some of the things that patrons at restaurants do that you know drive the staff crazy?
Oh, there are so many things that drive the staff crazy. You know, one of the biggest ones is people who want to change everything on the menu. You know, I want this, but I don't want this sauce, and I don't want this vegetable. And, you know, you've got to go back to the kitchen and say to the chef, you know, that woman out there, the chef is going to scream at you. It's really awful. The other thing is that people can be unbelievably rude to waiters and waitresses. There's a whole attitude of respect that you deserve as a waiter. And if you don't get it, it's very annoying. And a patron does that at his peril, I think.
Did you eat out a lot as a kid?
Yes. My parents were older when I was born. My dad was 50, my mother was 40. And they had a life. And they sort of expected me to fit into their life. And also because my mother was not the world's greatest cook, we fortunately went out a lot. And we lived in New York. And my mother, she used restaurants in a great way. Even though she was taste blind, And she really wasn't interested in food. She was very interested in the theater of restaurants. So I grew up in the great days of Restaurant Associates, when they were doing The Forum of the 12 Caesars and La Fonda del Sol and all these really exciting theatrical restaurants. And we didn't have a lot of money, so we wouldn't go eat in those restaurants, but we would go and have a drink and sit in the bar and look at the restaurant, and then we would go someplace cheap for dinner.
You know, in talking about how your mother liked the theater of restaurants, you like to write about the kind of subculture within the restaurant. For example, a recent review, you wrote, if you are over 30, weigh more than 105 pounds, favor bright colors or bite your fingernails, Bond Street could do you damage. No matter how confident you may be in the real world, it's hard to face an entire universe of thin, young, beautiful people dressed in black without wondering what you are doing there. Do you enjoy writing about the subculture that a restaurant seems to attract?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think you need to know that. I mean, people say, well, how is the food? And that's only a piece of it. I mean, if you're walking into a restaurant, you want to know what the people are wearing, what they look like, how you're going to feel when you're there. And if you're walking into a really hip scene dressed like Grandma Moses, you're going to feel ridiculous. I love that whole side of restaurants, that whole ability you have to walk in and be somebody else for the time that you're there. You know, it's like meeting new people. You get to reinvent yourself, and that's one thing that restaurants do for us.
Well, Ruth Reichel, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Are you off to go to a restaurant now?
Yes, of course.
Well, enjoy.
Thank you.
Ruth Reichel recorded in 1998 when she was restaurant critic for the New York Times. She's now editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine. Her new memoir, Comfort Me with Apples, is a follow-up to her bestseller, Tender at the Bone. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
We got fish for supper. We got fish for supper. We got fish for supper. First one thing, then another. We ain't got no menu. But our fish will send you. We got fish for supper. First one thing, then another. Last night we had bread and fish. Tonight we got fish and bread. Tomorrow night we're gonna change that dish and have plain fish instead. We got fish for
Major
supper.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The documentary about baseball Hall of Famer Hank Greenberg is showing this month on Cinemax. Coming up, we hear from his son, Steven Greenberg. David Bianculli reviews last night's concluding episode of Survivor, and Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie, Chopper.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Convicted killer Mark Chopper Reed became a celebrity in his native Australia with two bestsellers and frequent TV appearances in which he detailed his life in crime. Over the years, he's been suspected of embellishing his resume. He boasts of committing 19 murders, but he's been convicted of only one. The Australian movie Chopper examines Chopper Reed's life of crime and fame. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
There are an awful lot of brawls going on in Chopper, which isn't a surprise considering the film's hero. Mark Chopper Reed is an ex-convict and violent offender, a killer really, whose best-selling accounts of his career and frequent television appearances have made him a national celebrity in Australia. Chopper the film is director Andrew Dominik's account of Reed's life from his incarceration in the mid-1970s through a mini crime spree he pulled off in the mid-1980s, a spree that exclusively victimized other low-level criminals. But those aren't the main bouts in the movie. For the headliner in one corner, armed with a savvy nose for notoriety, we have the champion self-promoter Chopper Reed, played by Australian stand-up comedian and TV star Eric Bana. For the challenger, we have first-time filmmaker Dominik, a man who would very much like to knock the wind out of Chopper a few times, if not silence him completely. Dominik portrays Chopper as a weirdly conflicted man who seems on the edge of psychosis, but is not quite there yet. After a barbarous assault on a fellow prisoner that leaves him bleeding profusely on the floor, a sorrowful Chopper offers apologies, then starts kidding around about how much fun he and the wounded man will have after he gets better. Dominik finds Chopper's bizarre sense of guilt more interesting than his crimes, but it's his flair for celebrity that really takes center stage. Chopper is constantly talking himself up to anyone who will listen. When he finally gets out of prison after serving 10 years for attempting to kidnap a judge, he decides he's now going to live the life of a legendary figure, a kind of brass-knuckle Robin Hood. Chopper has alienated so many criminal associates that he decides to be the scourge of the underworld, an undercover hitman for the police. Here, he makes an offer to a couple of Melbourne detectives who want nothing to do with him.
I'm a bloody disappointment to you, aren't I?
What?
Well, you've probably read all the newspaper stories about me, and you've heard the word on the street about me, and you've got a picture in your head of what bloody Chopper Reed's like, and we're sitting here at this bar, all very nice and cosy, and I'm a bit of a bloody letdown to you.
What are you on about, mate?
I feel like I should be doing more for you, Mr. Downey, to be honest. You know, there's crims out there, they get around like a bloody protected species. You know, why? I mean, look, I know you blokes don't mind turning the occasional blind eye whilst I deal out my own bit of poetic justice, right?
Actually, Mark, that's not the way we operate.
I understand perfectly, Mr. Downey. There are certain things that you can't appear to condone.
Look, appearance has got nothing to do with it. We don't condone them.
Scenes like this are clearly meant to expose Chopper's penchant for self-deception. But the self-promoting convict gets his own back in a strange way. Eric Bana, who plays Chopper, an actor virtually unknown outside of Australia, gives an absolutely startling, remarkably charismatic performance. He dominates each scene he's in simply by being there. Bana has caught the killer's strange blend of megalomania and remorseful sanity, perfectly and subtly. All he needs to do is shift his gaze and force a sheepish grin, and he shows us an internal struggle of remarkable complexity. In Australia, though, Bana is a star. Casting him as a killer is similar to, say, hiring Steve Martin to play John Gotti. An American audience would know simply from Martin's presence that a satirical or at least comic point was being made. But Chopper, which was a big hit in its homeland, loses that pop culture context abroad. We haven't read Chopper's bestsellers either, though at least one is now available in paperback. We don't know whether Chopper is overexposed or that Bana is primarily a funny man. All we can see is this wild man of Australia, repulsive yet charismatic and almost hypnotically watchable. Whatever points Dominic scored with Australian audiences, Chopper wins by a knockout here.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. The documentary The Life and Times of Hank Greenberg is currently showing on Cinemax. Coming up, we hear from the Baseball Hall of Famer's son, Stephen Greenberg. This is Fresh Air. The Life and Times of Hank Greenberg is a documentary about America's first Jewish baseball star. It's showing this month on Cinemax. Hank Greenberg was chosen Most Valuable Player in 1935 and 1940, and in 1938 was three home runs shy of breaking Babe Ruth's record. He played first base and outfield for the Detroit Tigers from 1933 to 46, and for the Pittsburgh Pirates in 1947. He was voted into the Hall of Fame in 56. Last year, when the documentary opened theatrically, I spoke with one of his sons, Stephen Greenberg, who's interviewed in the film. Stephen played five seasons in the minor leagues, then became a lawyer and sports agent, and served 3 years as deputy baseball commissioner under Faye Vincent. The documentary focuses on the anti-Semitism Hank Greenberg faced early in his career and what a hero he was to Jewish Americans. I asked Stephen Greenberg about the anti-Semitism his father contended with in his own ball club.
Well, he had a couple of instances early in his career, and again, the times were so different. It's almost like it might as well have been a different century compared to what I knew growing up. But he had one teammate who, without any particular malice, came over and looked at him sort of curiously when they first met and kept staring at him. And my dad said, "What's the problem?" He said, "Well, I heard that Jews had horns, and I don't see your horns. Where are they?" And this was a fellow who'd grown up in Alabama, and this was what he, growing up as a kid in the 1920s, was taught, that the Jews had horns. So those kinds of stereotypes, which seem absurd and ridiculous in the year 2000, existed then, and he had to deal with them.
Although he had to face a lot of discrimination within baseball and from the fans, he was also like an incredible hero to Jewish baseball fans. And I think that has to do in part with the fact, I mean, not only was he the first great Jewish baseball player, but I think his presence was particularly meaningful for a lot of Jewish people because one of the stereotypes of Jews is that they aren't particularly physical, strong, or athletic.
Oh, well, I think that's absolutely true, Terry. One critic wrote, and I think it's an interesting insight, that prior to the establishment of the State of Israel, when Jews wanted to look for one of their own who did something heroic in a physical sense, it was Hank Greenberg. After the establishment of the State of Israel, of course, we have many examples in Israel, and in fact, Israel itself almost becomes the symbol of Jewish physicality. But certainly in the 30s and in the 40s, when my dad was playing, most Jews were not on the athletic field, and he was a tremendous hero in the Jewish community, and really well beyond that. The most stirring moment that I've had vis-a-vis my dad in my lifetime came in 1983 when his uniform was retired, his uniform number was retired in Detroit. And I went back with him, and there was a 55,000 fan capacity crowd at Tiger Stadium, and between games of a doubleheader, he was called onto the field and his number retired, and 55,000 fans stood up, and I guarantee you most of these were not Jews, and most of them never saw him play. These were children and grandchildren of people who may have seen him play, and gave him about a 3-minute standing ovation, and it was amazing to me how much he was remembered and how much his legend is still alive in the city of Detroit.
Did he know Jackie Robinson, and did he relate to the threats and the slurs that Robinson faced when he integrated Major League Baseball?
Absolutely. And it comes out in the film. One of the coincidences of his career is that at the end of 1946, my dad was sold to the Pittsburgh Pirates after a long career in Detroit. He almost retired but decided to play that 1 year. And 1947, of course, was the year that Jackie Robinson broke in with the Brooklyn Dodgers. So my dad saw as a new National Leaguer firsthand what Jackie was going through and really did go out of his way, reached out to Jackie. I think Jackie acknowledged that Hank Greenberg was the first star player who reached out to him and encouraged him and gave him a big boost. Certainly my dad recognized that much of what Jackie was going through was similar to what he had gone through, although he said to his dying day that he thought he had it tough till he saw what Jackie went through, and it was nothing compared to what Jackie went through.
Did your father think of himself as religious, and did his sense of his own Jewish identity change when he faced so much discrimination?
He had a very strong religious grounding and sense of himself as a Jew. He was raised Orthodox. However, he was not a religious person. He was not. He didn't go to temple, and he was what I guess you would call a secular Jew today, but still one with a very, very strong Jewish identity. Obviously never denied his Jewishness, and was very, very cognizant at an early age of the fact that he was a symbol to an entire community of Jews and the importance of what that meant as a role model.
There's a story that's told in the documentary about him, The Life and Times of Hank Greenberg, that I'm going to ask you to tell. This is the story of how he had to decide whether or not to play on the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah, in a game in which the Tigers had the chance to win the pennant.
Yes, and what amazes me, Terry, about this story is that he was only 23 years old when this happened, and he had no agent. In those days, players didn't have agents and advisors. He had to deal with this really all on his own in a strange city with relatively few friends around. But the year was 1934. The Tigers were pushing for the pennant, fighting against the Yankees in the latter days of September. And the Jewish holidays rolled around. Actually, on Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, he sought help from the rabbis, the elders in the Jewish community in Detroit. And the chief rabbi of Detroit apparently found a piece of scripture from the Talmud that said that on Rosh Hashanah, the children played in the streets of Jerusalem, and literally cleared my father to play on Rosh Hashanah. He did play, hit two home runs, and the Tigers won the game 2-1. The following week, however, was Yom Kippur, which is the Day of Atonement and the holiest of holy days in the Jewish calendar, and there was no question that he wouldn't play that day. He didn't. He sat out. He went to synagogue, apparently walked in and received a standing ovation in the middle of the service in the Orthodox temple in Detroit, which is, let's say, not the usual custom. And the Tigers lost that day, but the good news is they went on to win the pennant. Out of that episode, I think much of my father's legend has grown. He is remembered to this day as not having played on Yom Kippur. And it is amazing at how many Yom Kippur sermons around the country I hear that to this day the rabbi will refer to the fact that Hank Greenberg didn't play baseball on Yom Kippur.
You tell a story in your father's autobiography, which was written with the sports writer Ira Burkow, about how once on Yom Kippur he told all of his kids, to take off from school, and he took you all to the planetarium, not to synagogue.
He had the right idea. He just couldn't do it in the traditional sense. He wasn't, as I said, he was not a traditional religious person. Ironically, he lived by the Ten Commandments. Those were his guiding principles. But he didn't believe that organized religion was for him. Accordingly, you're absolutely right. When I was about 11 years old, one day we got up and Dad said, "You're not going to school today, boys. I'm taking you. It's a special day. It's Yom Kippur, and Jews don't go to school and don't go to work on Yom Kippur. But get dressed. We're going somewhere." So we got dressed, and he took us to the planetarium. We sat in the darkened planetarium looking up at the stars for about a half an hour, and then went home, and I thought it was great, and for some time thought that Yom Kippur was the day that the Jews went to the planetarium.
Yeah. Did he play baseball with you when you were a kid?
He played all sports with us, mostly tennis. When he stopped playing baseball, he took up tennis with an absolute passion. He played every day. Even into his 70s, he was probably playing 5 days a week. He passed away when he was 75, prematurely from cancer, but up until the time he got sick, he was an avid tennis player. So when we grew up in Cleveland, he was getting into his tennis career, if you will. So he had us out on the tennis court hitting balls from the time we were six. And sure, he played some baseball with us, but never encouraged us to play organized baseball, rather just wanted us to play all sports and understand the value of physical exercise.
Was it inhibiting to learn from a brilliant athlete who was your father?
You know, it wasn't so much, what it was intimidating. I mean, he was, first of all, a big guy, and we were little tykes then, and he was competitive. And if you're, the hardest thing for me, and I used to still get shivers in my 30s, was playing doubles with him and having him as my partner and having him glare at me when I missed an easy shot. Boy, that was withering. He was a very competitive guy, and he had a very loving father, and I think we became, my brother and I, very good athletes, in part because we understood the value of hard work, and we didn't want that glare if we made a mistake.
Steven Greenberg, you played baseball professionally for a while. You were in the minor leagues for about 5 years.
Right.
Did your father want you to be a major league player, or did he try to discourage you from that life?
I think he was very proud. He never pushed me in that direction. It became apparent when I was in college, though, that I had a little bit of talent, and I really liked it. And I made the decision, having never played Little League or any organized baseball as a kid, to play in a summer league during college, a college league for sort of top college players that they have up in Cape Cod, still have it up there in the summer. And I think he was very proud. I was drafted by the Washington Senators and signed a contract with them. He never came around much. He would come probably once a season in my five minor league seasons and come and stay wherever I was playing for 2 or 3 days and watch a few games. But he didn't want to be in the way. He understood that when he showed up at a minor league ballpark in Geneva, New York, or Spokane, Washington, that suddenly all the press was out and the cameras, and it put pressure on me, which it did. So he didn't want that, and he didn't need to be in the limelight. So he watched it from afar. I think he was proud. I think he was glad I gave it a shot. He would have loved it had I made it to the big leagues, but he certainly didn't pressure me.
Did you feel bad that you couldn't fill your father's shoes in baseball?
Well, I wasn't stupid enough to ever think I could fill his shoes. I did read the record books, and I realized that I was not going to be hitting 58 home runs and doing what he did on the field. I thought I had a chance to be a journeyman major league player, and when it panned out that I was going to be a journeyman AAA player, I went back to law school and never regretted it.
You went to law school and ended up representing players.
I did.
Was your approach towards salary negotiation and how much is a fair amount for a baseball player to earn, was that all affected by your father's achievements and his attitude towards salary?
Well, he was a tough negotiator on his own behalf. I would have loved to have had a player with his statistics to argue on behalf of, because it would have been pretty easy pickings in this environment today. I remember one conversation I had with him. I had a young player who was a good little player, second baseman. He'd hit about 246 the year before. So I was talking to my dad about what I would ask for in terms of a raise the next year. He said, well, what did he hit? I said, he hit 246. He said, you're going to ask for a raise with 246? You should just ask for a uniform. It didn't make sense to him the way salaries had exploded in light of the level of performance that he was seeing. He had no qualms about the great players, the star players making huge money. What he didn't really understand is how the journeyman players or the mediocre players could be getting these huge million-dollar salaries. And that's just, I think, the transition of baseball from a game, a pastime, to part of the entertainment industry.
Well, Steven Greenberg, I thank you very much for talking with us.
I appreciate it. My pleasure.
Steven Greenberg is featured in the documentary about his father, The Life and Times of Hank Greenberg. It's showing this month on Cinemax. Our interview was recorded last year. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews last night's concluding episode of Survivor. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. The second season of the CBS series Survivor ended last night. TV critic David Bianculli weighs in on the results, the final show, the series in general, and its future.
Doesn't get any better than this. Three votes Tina, three votes Colby. In true Survivor tradition, it comes down to one final vote. Oh my. The winner of Survivor, the Australian Outback.
Even for someone who's a big fan of Survivor, and I am, last night's finale had a lot of flaws. The two-hour episode was stretched thinner than a piece of warm taffy, with only one sequence of actual suspense per hour. There was the immunity challenge, which protected the winner from being voted off in the first hour, and the jury presentation and vote in the second. Whole chunks of last night's Survivor the Australian Outback just sort of moped along like they were in slow motion. And they were. Also, the whole idea of putting the final vote on ice for a few months and returning from the Outback to crown the winner live on TV last night was clunky. It solved one problem, because the Survivor folks didn't have to sweat out keeping the secret this time around. But it created another problem, because Tina wore makeup and Colby didn't have a beard. The immediacy of that contest and the win had been removed. So those are the complaints about last night's show. But you know what? Overall, it still worked, because, like the first series, which ended with scheming Richard as the Machiavellian winner, Survivor was a TV mystery that kept on entertaining. Last summer, Survivor took its players and viewers a while to figure out. This time, everyone was much more savvy. We all knew that alliances would form quickly and immunity challenges would be crucial. Yet there were surprises along the way. Mike fell face first into that campfire and essentially shifted the balance of power to the competing tribe. Jerry got voted off early and emerged as the TV villain you most love to hate since the glory greedy days of J.R. Ewing. And last night, it was a surprise when Colby, after winning immunity, voted off Keith instead of the more likable and formidable Tina. It wasn't that Colby, who had played the game very shrewdly up to that point, was unaware that he'd stand a better chance of winning if Keith was his final rival. He even said as much the morning after making his decision.
I've been selfish in the way I've played. However, I'm choosing to go into the finals with Tina, and that's not a selfish move. Because if I was 100% selfish, I would choose to go in with Keith. I feel certain I probably could have won against Keith. I don't even know that I have a 50-50 shot against Tina.
In the end, Colby was right. He lost. But there was something a little noble, as well as a little short-sighted, about that surprise decision. And the vote itself, from the former contestants Colby and Tina faced as jurors, was a 4-3 decision, just like last summer's final tally. For the second Survivor in a row, it all came down to one vote. Not even the presidential race in Florida got that close. The next Survivor, we learned last night, will be in Africa. Let's hope CBS goes a little lighter on the product placement next time, and tightens up the pace of the final hours. Otherwise, there's nothing here that's broken and nothing else to fix. Unlike most of its reality show copycats, Survivor is watchable as well as a winning formula. If Survivor is cast well before it begins and packaged well for television after its contests are held, the show literally writes itself. And with the threat of a writer's strike still looming today, that may be the most valuable Survivor prize of all.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. The great jazz drummer Billy Higgins died of kidney and liver failure yesterday. He was 64. In today's New York Times obituary, Ben Ratliff writes, "Since the late 50s, when he made a name for himself by playing on Ornette Coleman's early recordings, Higgins was one of the most musically sensitive jazz players around. His style did not call attention to itself. His musicianship simply raised the standard of playing of every band he played in." Higgins recorded with Thelonious Monk, Lee Morgan, Hank Mobley, Sonny Rollins, David Murray, and Jackie McLean. Earlier this year, I asked Jackie McLean about playing with Higgins. Now, what makes his drumming so special for you?
His concept of time and his talent for listening. I mean, he's a marvelous accompanist. He hears everything a musician plays and responds to it. Quietly, without being overbearing or getting in the way. and he's got a beat that is just the happiest thing on earth. You know, his beat is just incredibly marvelous. I mean, I can be depressed and feel like the weight of the world is on my shoulders, and once I step up on the stage with Billy Higgins and look back there and see him playing, I'm in good shape because he's got such a marvelous feel.
We'll close today's show with Billy Higgins as featured on the classic 1963 Lee Morgan recording, The Sidewinder. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Schurach. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Random House Incorporated's Delacorte Press Division, publisher of Far Appalachia, Following the New River North by Noah Adams. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Colin Firth. He's starring in the new movie Bridget Jones' Diary. In the novel, Bridget has a crush on Firth because of his performance in the TV adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. We'll talk about both roles, and he'll read an excerpt of a short story he wrote, which was published by Nick Hornby. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.